One thing you said to Phil is how you had to bring back, you felt the quality of the story, the series in the last few years. And we've noticed, like, the last few books that come out, there's been some great books coming out.
Thank you.
Like, the Welcome to Bear Country, I think, is almost as good as...
Well, we love Welcome
yeah.
to
Bear Country. Yeah, me too. The public hates it.
Really?
Yeah, and you should look at the reviews online. People
oh,
hate it.
Oh, how come?
They don't like Cousin Tex. They hate him.
Oh, I like that our, Cousin Tex coming
he's
back.
He's always been one of our favorites.
Yeah, and people, you look at, like, on Goodreads or Amazon, and the customer, people, like, most of the people say, I don't like Cousin Tex. What's he doing in this book? Why is he here?
We don't
like
the old tree came back, though.
That's funny, and I haven't gone online and read any
yeah,
you
read.
Should. It's very interesting. Very consistent. One person said that Cousin Tex is a jerk. And I was very puzzled by it. I talked to Eleanor and Marianne about it. Because I just saw this kind of cute book about the country
yeah.
cousin, like the country mouse and the city mouse.
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
a traditional kind of story.
There's some throwbacks, like classic
oh,
stuff.
Oh, I love that. They go to visit all the iconic
yeah.
places. And, you know, like, I haven't seen, you know, Spooky Old Tree. I don't think he's ever been in another book except Spooky Old Tree. And
I don't think
see
it
that had. Again was really
I think cool. it was in a pop-up book. Once.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've never been in a regular book. So I thought this. And
I
was talking to Eleanor and Mary, and they were puzzling, why do they hate Cousin Tex? So I asked my wife, Laura, because she's the fountain of wisdom because she's really smart. She's a doctor and she knows what she knows stuff. And also, and I never thought that she's originally from the South. She grew up in Miami, went to school in North Carolina, in Louisiana, and worked most of her life in Texas before moving up here 10 years ago. And she said, it's because Cousin Tex is from Texas.
I was going to say.
I said, really? She said, yeah. Probably these people who are giving these negative reviews, they're probably from, like, Portland or Boston or somewhere
yeah.
else. And
yeah.
they see Texas, and they're just like, their dander gets up, and they just like, hate that. Hate the Tex.
I'm from Texas. It makes my dander.
But I said, you mean people would really allow that kind of red state, blue state thing to creep into their thinking about silly little... And she said, yeah, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
So you live and learn.
Welcome back to Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bearcast. I'm your host, Phil Gonzalez, and we're not covering a book this week. It is part two of my meeting with Mike Berenstain. Yes, a few weeks ago, we had the first part of this where myself and Brad Mariska and Jeremy Gloff traveled to the Berenstain Studios. We chatted a little bit with Mike. This is part two. We're going to be hearing a little bit more of the conversation we had with him. So sit back, relax, and enjoy another look at my meeting with Mike.
Sometimes, you know, it's an interesting thing. If you look at online reviews and customer reaction, sometimes negative reaction is reflected in bad sales, but not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And also, sometimes good reaction is not reflected in good sales. You can have
sure.
books that what really tends to correlate is how many reviews you have,
mm-hmm.
whether they're good
okay.
or bad or indifferent. If there's lots and lots of reviews,
can
the
you
book
think
sells.
Of an example of a book that maybe got some bad customer reviews, but continues to sell well?
Yeah, the Berenstain Bears Show Some Respect.
Okay.
A Zondervan book, which is about, you know, multiple generational elder respect, like respect your parents and your parents should respect their parents. And of course, it's in Zondervan. I have the characters quoting like proverbs about
sure.
respecting your elders. Although that's the only religious element of the book, is quoting some biblical quotations about proverbs about respecting your elders. And it sells very well. It's one of the stronger sellers. And it has a good... A lot of people like it, but there's a real dichotomy. There's a large number of people who hate that book.
Interesting.
Because they don't think people should... people shouldn't be just respected because they're old. That's a bad thing to teach your kids, they say. That's just old-fashioned, corny, old garbage. I don't believe in that.
Do you also think, though, maybe... Because it's a Zondervan book, but it's not as overt. Like, a lot of those Zondervan
yes.
books say, like,
you know,
God loves me. And maybe they bought it thinking, not realizing it was going to have the
yes.
biblical context.
So, but the thing is, those people always say that.
Okay.
But there's another subset of people
just
who what they hate
the,
is that they, I don't think that's terrible to teach your child to respect the grandparents. Just because they're old, they should respect them for being a human being and all. And I said, yeah, okay, but why can't you respect people for being old too?
Yeah, right.
You know,
you can respect
that's okay.
your grandmother because she played in a one bear band when she was
right,
old.
Exactly. Now, what about the flip side of the coin? What's one that got really good reviews but didn't sell well?
God Bless Our Home.
Really?
It
just seems like a
Yeah.
No brainer. Like,
yeah, I thought it was a no brainer too.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't sell.
Huh.
Oh, and everybody loves it. It doesn't sell.
Look, my mother did the cover. It was one of the last things she did.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's just it's wonderful. It's just about it's a flashback to how they expanded the house for when Honey was born and all that. Mm-hmm. And it's all about isn't it wonderful home?
Yeah.
And
I always like this one.
It doesn't even have a religious content. It's just about God bless our home.
Right.
And they're thankful for their nice home. It's just it doesn't speak to people.
That's interesting, but they like it when they read it.
Yes, people who read it. But again, it hasn't had as many reviews.
Right.
Huh.
But if you like get some respect, it has a lot of negative reviews, but it has a lot of reviews.
Uh-huh.
People are interacting with it. Whereas this, obviously, people are just kind of, not that interested.
I feel like people are a little bit more transient than they used to be, so maybe they can't relate to the...
Maybe it's just people are renting more or moving around more.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it has to do with the 2008 real estate crisis where people all lost their mortgages and had to move. And I look at that and I think, again, no brain. I thought, I didn't necessarily think it would be a huge bestseller, but I figured it would be do fine.
It would be like at least a mid-range
sure. book. That it just,
is there any that came out that you didn't think would do as well as it did? That really
The Ramstein Bears Easter Story.
Oh, really? Because there's a coloring book version of that one, too.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to do it. Saunders said, we think you should do the Ramstein Bears and tell the Easter story. I mean, you mean the Easter story? You know, Jesus?
And yeah.
He said, oh, yeah, we would like that. Do you think that would do very well? I thought, they're out of their minds. Bears? Getting crucified. That's ridiculous. And so, but they kept coming. I said, no, I kind of would feel uncomfortable doing that. You know, I just feel that would be kind of sacrilegious to
right.
do that. And they said, well, we do VeggieTale books where Jesus is a grape and nobody minds that.
Oh, my gosh.
So I said, well, that's
when you say
true.
It out loud like that.
And I said, yeah, that's true, isn't it? I mean, VeggieTales, if the God people who have done VeggieTales haven't been struck dead by lightning, I'm probably safe.
Yeah.
So I thought about it.
That's a quote, right?
Yeah. So I thought about it, and finally they kept bugging me about it. And I thought, well, maybe there's some way I can do it where I can feel okay with it. So what I came up with was this elaborate idea that the Bears are going to Sunday school, and Sunday school puts on a performance
right.
of the Easter story, and it's this kind of cute, creaky performance. It's not threatening. So it's within the context of Bear World.
Yeah.
Sure.
So you're not saying that Jesus was a bear or Mary was a yeah. bear. It's these bears are acting out their version of it as bears in Bear Subworld.
Sure. You know? Right.
And so they said, we could, and they said, yeah, that's a good idea. We could do that. And so I thought, maybe. I did it because they kept bugging me. I had no idea. No thought that this was going to be a big hit.
But it took off.
It's now the number one bestseller. It has been ever since it came out. It's like, it sells 100,000 a year.
Wow.
That's great.
The coloring book version slid by me. I didn't find out about it.
That's very successful, too.
Yeah.
And in fact, that Easter story book has been so successful that they said, well, we want to do another Easter book. And I said, what do you mean? We already did the Easter book. I said, well, we ought to do another. And that's some other, I probably came up with Easter Sunday, where they about what their activities on Sunday, mm-hmm. on Easter Sunday, about the Bears. And that's been very successful.
Yeah.
And now they say, well, we want to do another. I said, you can't do another. So the Easter story morphed into the storybook Bible. Because once they did that, they said, hey, let's do a whole Bible. Interestingly enough, that, although it does okay, has not been that successful.
Is that the one with the squishy cover, kind of?
No, that's the board book version.
Oh, that's the board book version.
It is, but that's the board book version. There's a full version.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which was incredibly difficult to do. Time-consuming, difficult book. I think it came out right. But, they talked me into that because, hey, the Easter story is doing well. Let's do the full book. And I set it up as that. It's Papa Bear reading the stories, sure. and then they go into that world of what he's reading, and they come out at the end. So it's bookended as being in Bear World. That's was my theory. Nobody cares about that. That's just, it turns out nobody cares
about bears. About that.
I care about that.
Yeah, but I mean, when you look at like customer reaction to these biblical versions, like maybe one person will say, it's not right to show that biblical characters are bears. Everybody else, they don't care. Like he's smart.
Right.
No one knows the
living. That was what worried me about it. The whole idea that, well, are we saying that the character of the Bible are bears? That doesn't make any sense. And I don't know why the Easter story has done so well, but the story of the Bible has done okay. And people, they wanted the bears telling the story of the crucifixion, but they didn't want the bears telling other Bible stories particularly. Go figure. But anyway, they said, well, we want to do another Easter book, so how about we just take this Easter story that's in the storybook Bible and we publish that as the Berenstain Bears' very first Easter, like we did with the very first Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, yeah, but it's just the same story as the same story, except it's like a different pretext, different context. And they said, yeah, well, we think it would sell. I said, no. First, I said, that's ridiculous. We've already done the Easter story where they're acting out as a Sunday school play, and you want to publish the same thing in the same format, in the same line, 8x8 paperback, Living Lights line. It's the same thing. It's just it's not in the pretext of it being a Sunday school play, but it's the same story, the same plot. And they said, yeah. So I kept saying, no, I don't think that's a good idea. I think it's just redundant. It's just, and they said, well, but finally they just kept coming back and saying, well, and also I noticed that their idea of doing the Easter Sunday book really worked. And I thought that was dumb. So I figured, okay. So they're doing that. That's coming out next year. And also, it's increased the sale of the old non-religious Easter stories.
Oh, interesting.
They've gone up in sales because the Zonovan of an Easter story book is so prominent. It's like it's sucking along any other Easter subject.
And you can sell them all next to each other.
Yeah.
This is the real Easter eggs.
That's increased in sales.
Yeah. And I noticed that you've worked like... In the pages you showed us from the bullying book, you worked like the story of like Joseph and Terry.
I had to figure out some religious angle on that.
But it's interesting because the story in there.
Yeah, well, that's adapted from the story of the Bible, which has a very nice. I was very pleased with how.
So there's different ways to work those Bible stories
into
additional books beyond just holidays and. Right. I think it's clever and a nice way to
And also, you know, the problem that I have with the Living Lights books, I mean, originally when I proposed them, I wasn't thinking it was a whole line of, you know, like 100 books or something. I thought it would be like a dozen or something.
Yeah.
Maybe. So I had no idea. And it's very difficult to make these subjects work for very young children.
Yeah.
Like the subject of, I mean, God Bless Her Home, that was easy, but something like, well, like the Easter story, that was a great challenge. How do you tell the Easter story when you're trying to make sure that it's accessible to three-year-olds? And this one I'm doing, Why Do Good Bears Have Bad Days? It's basically based on the book of Job.
Mm-hmm.
That was my gimmick.
Yeah.
But then to actually write it and have it work for little kids. So I'm always doing things like, well, I'll put this story of Joseph in it because that'll be, you know, visually appealing and interesting. Mm-hmm. Rather than just having a bunch of characters standing around and lecturing each other. So I'm always trying to figure out ways to make it into some kind of interesting visual narrative rather than just, this is something you're supposed to learn, kids, which people think they want that, but they don't really want that.
Right.
Well, you said that some of the newer books have given new life to some of the older books.
Yeah.
What are a couple of the, we were kind of having this debate in the car coming up about, you know, we know that... The Truth and Learn About Strangers and New Baby still sell really well.
Yeah.
What are a couple of those first-time books that... Because we just...
Which ones have gone down?
So. Well, first of all, which ones are still, like, at the top? I'm always curious. And which ones are, like, in danger? Will all those first-time books always be in print? Or?
No. Some of them are not even in distribution now.
Okay.
They sort of... They'll sell them, like, you know, in a special order to Walmart or something.
Right.
All the ones after, say, 2000 are not really in general distribution now.
Mm-hmm.
So the later ones. The ones before that are all in print and in general distribution, I think. Pretty sure. But they vary all over the place in terms of how they sell. And that's something characteristic of children's publishing in general now because of just the general changes in publishing and distribution books. But some of them that used to be really perennial huge sellers are falling off. And I think... The one that comes to mind most is Get the Gimmies.
Really? Someone was just saying yesterday that's their favorite.
Really? Yeah. It's one of my favorites too. But that always used to be like one of the top dozen, always, for decades. And over the last, I'd say, 5-6 years, I've noticed it started to go down.
Interesting.
And if you think about, what do we know about modern parenting that would fit in with that downtrend? It's all about basically controlling your kids' behavior in public. And I don't think people really want to do that anymore.
No, they
care about it. You know, I just don't think it's a priority anymore. I seriously think that's why that book has tailed off. And it's not that the book doesn't sell. It's just that you can see it trailing off. It's not a bestseller. It's going down like a mid-list book.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so what's happened is that the society and the culture has changed. It used to be that was 100% of parents were concerned about that issue. Now it's maybe 50%.
Sure.
So the book's trail.
I'm a server, so I get to see firsthand parents dealing with their children.
Oh, yeah. And I, you know, as I was raising my parents, like my kids, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And again, that was parents were, you know, if your kid misbehaved in public, you take them for a walk, you take them outside, you take them to go see the ducks, you know, whatever you're going to do. And then as an older, you know, parent, I began to see this changing in public, say after 2000. It's a demographic change. So that's a good example.
Have you gotten, you know, we have this conversation a lot because we've started a collector group and we found a few other pretty serious fans and collectors.
How many are there?
Well, there's now about 150 people in the group. But
this is Bernstein Bear Collectors?
Yes. Yeah. But...
I thought it was just you three guys.
No,
I don't collect.
Well, but how do you describe? You're an aficionado. You're a historian.
I'm keeping the conversation going.
You're a popular historian.
Yes. But the thing is, like a lot of them are casual collectors. You know, they have 40 or 50 books and they treasure them and they want to make sure to like they want to know which ones to get for their kids and what's new and all this sort of stuff. But we've only discovered, you know, probably two or three other like really serious collectors. And we were just wondering if you ever get fan mail from adults.
I rarely get contact from adults, collectors or people. Sometimes you get contact from adults, but it's about their experience as parents of their kids loving books.
Sure.
Especially if it's a kid who had some particular issue that, like if the kid's autistic or something, they felt that they helped the kid with life. Because you get, you know, letters like that. But I don't, occasionally we've gotten contact either, like, usually through the website. Mm-hmm. You know, you can contact us through the website. People who have some specific kind of historical or collector's question, but that's pretty rare.
Yeah.
So the answer is no. But your question is sort of why should that be, I guess.
We do because we've been out there like long enough and we're pretty present on the internet and we're buying items and posting things and blogging and now with the podcast, it's just I thought there might be more people out there and there might be a few people lurking in the weeds. But
I could come up with a guess. Obviously, we're discussing how I don't understand a lot of things that happen in popular culture, like cousin Tex. Most kids' properties, or in the business they're called an IP, an intellectual property, most kids' brands that become hugely popular and successful, although they're for kids, they're not really just for kids. Like, is Bugs Bunny a kid's character? Right. Not really. I mean, kids like Bugs Bunny, but it really was intended for all ages. Yeah. It's zany, antic, kind of subversive humor that adults liked from the beginning, too.
Right.
Most of these things really have very broad commercial demographic range. They're not really focused on children. Bernstein Bears, they're really focused on children. They're for kids and for parents of kids.
Yeah.
So once you're not a kid anymore, and once you've moved on from parenthood, it's not relevant anymore. It's not that you dislike them or you don't have fond memory of them,
right.
But it's not something maybe that you're going to focus on as an adult. Like the opposite extreme would be, I think, Hello Kitty. Now, ostensibly, you look at Hello Kitty and you think, well, that's a thing for children, but it's not. Kids don't have anything to do with Hello Kitty.
Right.
You don't actually Hello Kitty. Hello Kitty is a thing for adults, mostly women, to collect.
Yeah. And it's an aesthetic.
It's an aesthetic. Yeah. So I think that's if you look at that as the opposite end of things, the Bernstein Bears is on the other side. They're thinking that's really another extreme. I bet there's not a lot of collectors of Barney or Teletubbies.
Yeah,
right.
You know, that's something.
I'm sure there's one.
It's little kids under the age of three love those things.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's not something that once they get older they're gonna start. You know, studying the history of them and collecting them. So Bernstein Bears is somewhere in between.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's something that you've picked up on because that's how I think you maybe kind of came to this podcast in the first place.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. I want to know. Like, you three guys. I want to know your personal history. I want to know why. You know, each one.
Why don't the Bears focus more on guys our age?
I want to know. We'll start with you, Phil.
So it was the sweetest thing. So,
why did you get focused on the Bears in the first place?
Well, I have kids. I have a 15-year-old and a 6-year-old. And so I, for 15 years now, I've been back with the Berenstain Bears because the books.
And what was your experience with them as a kid?
Oh, I had a bunch of Berenstain Bears books. I mean, I could still recite the entirety of The New Baby.
But were they like your favorite thing, or just one of the things you liked?
Well, it's hard to say because I had hundreds of books as a kid.
Right.
I was a bookish kid, so like my parents just bought. I said shelves of these. It was the late 70s, early 80s, so it was kind of the era when the little thin books were really coming into vogue.
Sure.
But,
Only Reason at Random House.
It was the Berenstain Bears New Baby, Berenstain Bears Go to the Doctor, and Berenstain Bears, I want to say Visit the Dentist.
Visit the Dentist.
Yeah, there were a group of six that came out in, I guess, 80, 81, 82, whatever.
And I read those over and over again, so they stuck with me, and then, of course, the ABC, the TV series came out.
Right.
And I was just a television kid, so I was obsessed with that show because I was like, well, here's these characters I love, but here's this expanded universe, and they have like friends and neighbors, and then the what happened was when the PBS series came out, I had a child at that point.
I see.
And I was like, oh, there's a new cartoon. I was like, this isn't the Saturday morning cartoon. This is different. This has a different feel. It's so much more gentle. And like,
yeah, the PBS had, they had actually censored the viewing of everything.
Oh, yeah. Like, I was like, brother and sister.
We called them the PBS censors.
Yeah.
They would say things like, does Too Tall have to be so mean in a show about a bully?
I bet.
And my dad and the writers would say, well, but he's a bully. It's a show about a bully. Yeah, but can't be, he can't be a nicer bully, a sweeter bully. So they kind of backed off the bullying a little bit to make PBS happy. Things like that over and over again.
So I have kids, and so I was reading these books over and over and over and over and over again, and my ex-kids were reading them over and over and over again. And I started realizing there was a continuity.
Right.
Because I'm obsessed with timelines. And so I would always make my kids read them in the order in which they were published. I'd be like, no, we can't read this one yet because that's not the next one in line.
I bet that your kids love that.
So it started making me pick up on how the characters were developing and the artwork was developing. And I started wondering, like, well, why did this character get introduced here? And like, well, why did the road to this change and these neighbors are different now? So when I got into the world of podcasting and started guesting on friend shows, just as a personality, like I'm just a friend.
Yeah, because you have a theater background.
I do have a theater background. Yeah, and
that I understand.
I was like, well, I want to do a podcast. I want to do something that no one else is worth doing. So it was down to three ideas. It was Berenstain Bears, because I was like, I have a ton of the books, and I'm fascinating in the history. It was that. It was the Ninja Turtles. Or it was something else. I don't remember but everyone's done the Ninja Turtles. Like, there's like 1.5 billion blogs. But there was nothing out there about the Berenstain Bears. I was like, no one's like really just sat down and like read them straight through. And I was like, I wonder if they're still making these things. Because in the world of publishing, I was like, oh my gosh, I could just do this forever.
You can.
Yeah.
And so I checked.
Why would you want to do it forever, though?
Well, what's funny is I actually got on iTunes and I was like, first I need to see, not if there are, but I was like, I gotta see how many Berenstain Bears podcasts are out there first. Because I don't want to just be a drop in the ocean. Mm. And I look it up and I'm like, no one's done a Berenstain Bears podcast. How's it possible? So I just started. I read Down a Sunny Dirt Road and got my first episode up, and then you contacted me.
Yeah, like I don't know how I found, but like immediately, like your first episode dropped, maybe you had two episodes out, and I just randomly, like, because I'm searching for Berenstain Bears stuff like literally every day. So it showed up in a Google result, and I was like, oh, what? And I think I messaged you right away, and I was like, there's a podcast, and the guy like lives in Minnesota.
Okay, well, I understand where you're coming from with it, Brad. I never really got the story of how,
yeah.
I mean, you've been a collector of the, and we'll get to Jeremy too.
Yeah.
But we've been a collector going way back. I mean, I see you contributed stuff to a show we did and exhibit we did and everything.
Yeah.
But how did it start with you?
Okay, so when I was like, I don't know, 4 or 5, I got my first Berenstain Bears book, and I don't even remember for sure which one it was. It was one of the fairly early first 10 books. It would have been one of the first 10. And I really liked it, and I told my parents that I wanted another one. And I was obsessed with, I've always been OCD, anal retentive about like just order and completeness. And so when you open up the cover and you see the list of the titles there, and at that time there were probably 15 or 20 of them out, I was like, oh, I need to get one, and I need to like have them all on my shelf in order.
Yeah.
And then when you switch to the back, to the pictures.
Right.
And then in the middle of all the pictures, it said, collect them all.
Right.
And that was the
that day. Was Janet Schulman's idea. I always think in terms of editors.
It worked.
You know? Oh my gosh. Because that was, I was like, I have to collect them all. And I just never stopped. Now I did, there was a pause, like, in high school, you know, when I got to be like too old to read Berenstain Bears books, or at least publicly acknowledge that I was still reading them, you know, I wasn't collecting. So there was actually a lot of the books that came out in the 90s, like the big chapter books, I didn't actually buy until I actually went to college. So when I got to college, that was A, when I got my first credit card, and it's also about the time that eBay, like, happened.
So that morphed into the collecting.
And
from
that's
collecting
when
the actual books for your own interest.
Correct.
And it morphed into like
up until the age of 18 was just my own personal thing and whatever I would find at the local bookstore or at a garage sale. And then it was
when so I, it, that makes sense because it basically started as a childhood collect the line
yep.
the books
yeah.
that you're going to read. Yep. Like, well, I did that too. Like, no, I wanted all the Tintin books, you know.
Yeah.
You see the different ones. I don't have that one. I don't have that one that they don't publish here because it has racist things. I have to go find a Belgian edition or something. You know? So it developed from that.
Yeah, and it was so interesting because I didn't know that there were, you know, figurines and board games right. and all that. So that yeah. was, oh man, that was so exciting for me to discover, and it satisfied my personal desire to, like, have, I always have to have these projects.
Mm-hmm.
And this way I always had a project. But it was a project that was rooted in something that was, like, really important to me going all the way back to my early childhood. I mean, I still remember, like, curling up on my bed at the age of, you know, like, 5 years old and, like, reading Get in a Fight and In the Dark. And the one book that I always wanted that for some reason my parents would never get for me was The Truth, but we had it at the library.
Oh.
I think the cover was a little too crazy. Like, it was like
it's
the bird
scene.
With the weird,
it's
like, I think my parents were very, very conservative. So, like, that.
Do you think this is a Minnesota thing?
Yeah. So, like, I think that, like, even, like, for them, that cover was just too wild. It was too yellow. I love that cover, but I would read it at the library at school.
That's a zany book.
But the only book that I loved more than my Berenstain Bear book was Richard Scarry's Cars and Trucks and Things Like That.
Oh, those are wonderful books.
That's like the greatest children's book ever.
They're wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love those growing up too. Mm-hmm. Jeremy, what's your story?
Right.
You focused on book collecting.
Yeah, yes. I just collect the books. All right. I bought them all when I was a kid, like the same story. My life's been kind of crazy. So in the 90s, I gave away everything I owned and just traveled with my backpack. I sold my whole Berenstain Bear collection to my manager at Arby's for $20. All those rare books that I spent hundreds of dollars on there. The 2000s came. I'm a musician, so the last stuff I write is kind of dark and personal. So it was nice to go back to these kind of simple books that still taught heavy lessons. So I've kind of escaped into this simple world from my childhood.
Well, that's interesting.
I went onto his website because he had a bibliography.
Yeah, the bibliography is pretty good. Yeah.
I had all these questions. I'd email them. Then I went to the Library of Congress card catalog and went by the ISBN numbers to find books that no one knew about at that time. Because it was kind of like a wilderness in the early 2000s.
Oh, yeah.
So we became friends. And then we compared notes and bibliographies. And then that's how it kind of became definitive.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You all had different pathways.
Exactly. I think it's so crazy that you had a pretty, like, a huge collection as a kid and then sold them all and had to recollect them all.
Yeah. I got everything back, though, that I had.
Did you contact the manager of Arby's first?
No, she's on my Facebook. But she can have.
Well, one thing I said when I started doing this was I wrote to, before I even released an episode, I wrote to the Berenstain Bears Twitter account and I said, you know, I'm doing this show and I really want you guys to know I don't want to just release this out and surprise anyone, but also wanted to, I'm not approaching this the way a lot of people approach podcasts about popular culture, which is to snark on it and make fun.
Be ironic.
To be ironic. Yeah. To be like, look at this thing. Look how dumb this thing is.
Everything's ironic.
Isn't this great? And I think it took a lot of people, a lot of my friends too, by surprise, because they thought, oh, this guy's going to do a Berenstain Bears podcast. This will be hilarious. Like, he'll just make fun of all these books that we used to read when we were kids. And I was like, no.
It's sincere.
Like, to me, we think of this as, like you said, children's, you forget about it once you're not a kid anymore.
Right.
And we treat stuff like this as a disposable product. Like, it's, you know, once you don't need it, you don't need it. But I was like, but gosh, there was, these artists working on this. Like, this was a real a project, and it's a family business, and it's a family industry. And behind each thing that gets released into the public is a story. And I was like, and so I said in the message, I said, I want to take this seriously. I want to critique where I see critique is warranted, but also celebrate the works and treat them as a serious, ongoing, like, a storyline. And, you know, and we have fun. We goof around, and I have guests on who are just like, but I try to have guests on who can contribute to the conversation when I can. Mm-hmm. When I did Learn About Strangers, I had the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center program director on. It was a very serious, it was the only episode I ever did with a warning at the beginning. I was like, this one's going to have some pretty heavy talk because we're talking about the Jacob Wetterling case and missing children. And,
right.
And,
you know, my parents didn't want to do that book.
Yeah.
The publishers wanted to do it.
Why? It was a hard book.
Yeah, they thought they were crazy. It's like me with Easter Story. The Random House, and it was, well, I won't go into names of editors. That's how I think. But, the Random House, they said, you know, we think this is a subject you should do. The parents should issue a book about, you know, the stranger danger. And of course, this is, I forget when the book was published, 90.
It's like 85.
85.
Yeah.
And of course, this was a time when this was first becoming.
It was a huge.
Yeah.
Now, you know, and I think people don't really understand it in context because, you know, nowadays people have a much more sophisticated view of statistically about where danger comes from and realize that actual stranger abductions are relatively rare and that they look back at books of that era as being wildly inappropriate. And they really, but the thing is, people who didn't grow up and have before the 80s, they don't realize how wide open the society was before that. People assumed, when I was growing up, the idea that there was danger from strangers never occurred to anybody. It's like you just wander out into the world on your own all day, wherever you want to go.
Right.
Nobody's supervising you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, well, you know, they'd say, well, don't get into a car with somebody you don't know. But they didn't tell you anything like, what if they have some story? Or, you know, there were no real strict rules. It was just like, you know, you're out there, kid. Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, you know, the idea was that most people are just like friendly old grandpas. And, of course, the idea of child molestation, sexual molesting of children, nobody talked about that. That was not something anybody talked
sure.
about, you know, or thought about. You weren't allowed to even know about that.
Right.
You know, so obviously there was a lot of going on, but it was never talked about. So by the time the society began to open up after the 60s and people started to talk about all kinds of issues, things which were happening, kids being abducted and molested or killed by strangers, which had before been happening, but nobody talked about it, nobody thought about it, nobody wanted to acknowledge it, all of a sudden that was begun to be openly discussed and known about. And so fear about it exploded. And it wasn't because people were so irrational about understanding it. It was because it was something that had been suppressed. And this was the first opening up. So the overreaction to it was because of that.
Yeah.
It wasn't because people were crazy in the 80s. It's because
yeah.
that they... So anyway, the Random House, knowing that this was this huge subject that people wanted to deal with, they said, you know, we think you should do that. My parents said, no, we're not going to do it. These books are funny books. We're supposed to do a funny book about child molestation. You're crazy.
Right.
You know, how are we going to do that? And they said, well, Stan and Jan, we think that if anybody could come up with a positive, not too threatening, helpful way to deal with it, you can. And I said, oh, okay. So that's what they came up with. And it's been one of the most successful of their books ever done.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. It's the one people always point out to me.
And it's still a big bestseller, too.
Yeah, they're like, have you done the one? But yeah, so when I talked to her about it, I was like, have you heard of the Berenstain Bears? She's like, oh, we know Berenstain Bears. Mm-hmm. But they use it as a teaching tool.
Yeah.
Not because it's the same way they teach about
right.
stranger danger now. But they use it to say, like, well, this is how that they teach. This is why we don't teach this particular thing. But
right.
this is where the thinking comes from. And it's really interesting
yeah.
to that these books, Berenstain Bears, Manners, was it?
Forget
Their Manners. I interviewed a woman who runs a business in Minnesota called Mannerly Manners, where she teaches manner children. And she was like, oh, yes, Berenstain Bears, Forget Their Manners is one of our top.
Wow.
She's like, I use this as a teaching tool. Everyone knows Forget Their Manners. She's like, there's a few things I do differently, but it's a great place to start. And I just love how these books, the ones that touch on these specific subjects, resonate throughout.
They're iconic.
The specific industries
mm-hmm.
that relate to those, whether they're huge sellers or not, like those people are aware.
Forget Their Manners still sells very well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I go into my dentist's office, and sitting on the table is the Berenstain Bears Visit the Dentist. Still.
Okay, which is interesting, because that book is about dentistry from some ancient time.
Yeah, that's right.
No, it was
kind of archaic even when I was
there. I interviewed Alyssa's father, who was a dentist.
Yeah. You know?
And he read the book, and he's like, he was a dentist in New York. And I was like, so what are all the instruments here? And he's like, these would have been old when I was invented.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I think you may not, it makes, I probably figure out if you think about it, but a lot of the stuff that my parents, you know, they were, how old were they when they were doing
it? Oh, yeah.
60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And they grew up in the 20s,
right?
And 30, early 30s. And, you know, you assume, well, that they must have applied knowledge about what was going on in society when they were writing those books. And the answer is they did not. They just very often went back to their own childhood and wrote about what their concerns were.
I was
going
to
say,
if you learned to draw dentist equipment when you were a certain age, you're not going to go back and relearn to draw all new dentists.
And also, they would relate to things that were happening in the 50s when my brother and I were growing up. Well, by the 1980s and 90s, the 50s might have been, you know, like the Middle Ages.
But the thing of like, you look at Visit the Dentist and the equipment is almost unrecognizable, but the anxiety
the dynamics are
really and that's why it still sells really well. It's like the experience hasn't changed.
No, it's still, I'm not saying it shouldn't sell, I'm just thinking it's interesting. That's a book which really is in so many ways is of its time, or even not even of an earlier time, and yet it's still very successful.
We always say it's Bear Country.
It's
a weird modern agrarian, like,
I mean, and the original New Baby, The Birth of a Sister, I think is a wonderful example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was a book which, you know, people look at it now and they probably, was it 1974?
Yeah, right.
And people look at it and think, why are they being so evasive about the whole experience?
Right, she just suddenly said.
Because, okay, 1974 was at the end of that period, but you didn't do that in children. You didn't discuss openly pregnancy and birth, even as late as that. Now, things were changing.
Yeah.
But this was, you know, a book published for what was viewed as very, you know, broad audience, middle American audience, and there were books that were being published that were for more, you know, sophisticated audience, but that's not what the Berenstain Bears were being targeted for. So basically it's like, no, you don't talk about that. And it was just assumed as when that book was written. And so it's an artifact of its time.
It's still
a huge sell.
Papa, and that's the last book where they really behave like bears, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because Papa leaves the home.
And when he comes back,
the baby by herself. He comes back.
Yeah.
But no, that makes sense. And that was the one that kicked off the first time readers, right? Was that the first?
That was a look book.
That was the first eight. That was the second 8x8.
What was the first 8x8?
Nursery Tales.
Oh, right. And Go to School was the third one, wasn't it?
Yep, Go to School.
And then once the New Baby and Go to School took off and became explosive bestsellers.
That's when the first time books.
And that's when Random House said, hey, maybe we should like make this in a whole lot of books. And that was the origin of the first time idea, because the books had to do with first time experiences.
Right.
Which is completely meaningless to people now. In fact, Random House is going to change that.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I agreed. I said, yeah, let's change it, because nobody knows what that means anymore. They think it means first-time reader or something.
Oh,
they think it means easy reader. And they're not easy readers. They're hard readers.
Right.
You know? And so it's very destructive. It's meaningless as a logo. So they're going to change it to something like Berenstain Bears Classics or something.
Oh, okay.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
To position them properly in the marketplace. Yeah.
At that time, were there 8x8 paperbacks?
That's Ole Riesen. Ole Riesen was a Danish guy.
Okay.
Who in publishing, he started out in Golden Books. He was one of the guys with other dinosaurs of the business. He started the old little Golden Books lines back in the 40s. Sure. He was a wild, crazy guy. He had one walleye, so he never knew which way he was looking. And he came to Random House from Western. I'm part of the publishing. I grew up in the publishing business, so I still use terms without meaning to, which nobody knows what they mean. Western publishing was Golden.
It was Golden, yeah.
Right.
Western printing and publishing. And so in the business, nobody talked about Golden Books. You talked about Western. That's it. You did books for Western, you worked for Western. Anyway. So I still think that way. But it means Golden Books. So he came from Western to Random House in the late 60s. And the idea was he was going to make Random House into like a general mass market powerhouse. And there really weren't, I mean, Golden Books was it for mass market. People got out to supermarkets and convenience stores and things. That was Golden Books. There wasn't anybody else doing that. Maybe a few other minor players. But Random House, after their huge success with Seuss, in the children's market, they said, we're going to expand it. We're going to come, you know, a great general powerhouse. And Ole and other people who came over to Western, they were going to do that. And his first big idea was the picture back, which was the 8x8 paperback, 32 pages at that time, where it was the front cover and the back cover, the same cover reversed as a gimmick. And had a little Richard Scarry bunny on the corner.
Yeah.
And they developed it as a marketing program with 8x8 spinner racks designed for them, and the spinner racks were going to be sold as a package with the book. And it was just a huge success. I mean, the first years they were out, they were selling like 200,000, 300,000 copies of each title because it was the only thing out there like that. And they were and also it coincided with the explosion of the mall chains, like Beadle, Walden Books. And they all, so I don't know how many thousands of those things were out there at the height of the mall world.
Sure.
And everyone had a spinner rack in it. And they, you know, and there was no competition. And so that just exploded. And so then the idea is, well, we're going to do everything in 8x8 paperback. And so that's by the late 70s and early 80s, they're saying Bears. That's what are our lead Random House properties?
Right.
Berenstain Bears. Well, we'll try them in 8x8. You know, they're trying everything in 8x8.
It's definitely where I draw the line of modern children's book publishing, like not current children's book publishing, but what I consider modern children's book publishing. Mm-hmm. And the era, like when once that format starts showing up.
That's really the beginning.
There's like a clear line.
It's always Berenstain Bears and Little Critter.
Little Critter was Western.
When was Little Critter?
Early 70s. I don't know. Yeah.
Because that's what I was wondering.
Maybe like early 70s or maybe... No, around 1980, wasn't it?
I want to say it was...
Well, Mercer Mayer goes way back because he was doing all kinds of stuff before that.
I think he did like one book that just for the first one like in 74 and then really started in the 80s. Like
Because I had a bunch of them and I always thought it was cool because you know you could stack them next to each other. I could put my little Critter books next to my Berenstain Bears.
Yeah, and that was Western's attempt to come back and compete in the 8x8 market. They did, they called them look books, I think.
Right.
Because
right.
Little Critter was sort of followed a similar line, similar style of the Berenstain Bears. Like
yeah, and also Mercer, he would, every time my parents did a subject matter, he would do the same stuff.
Right. That's I remember that at the time.
It always seemed like second tier.
He even did a Missing Dinosaur Bone book at one point. In fact, he still.
And they went religious.
Yes, he did that, but it didn't work for
him. The Clifford books were...
It didn't work. They didn't sell them. Because it didn't make sense for the demographic. Little Critter is this kind of mischievous little naughty character.
Right, yeah.
And they didn't have any moral teaching. The reason that the Zondervan series worked, and I thought it would work this way, although I didn't know it would be this successful, is that I knew just from general feedback from people and just sense of how people were reacting to the Bears over the years... that there was a very strong following among very traditional families, and very traditional families in the U.S. are Christian families. Right. And not exclusively, but 90%. And I thought, well, that would probably be appreciated by that audience is if we did books that had specifically helpful religious content. And I thought it was a kind of a minor sideline, but it turned out it was not.
And you mentioned this when I interviewed you a year or so ago, you said that like you get some pushback from people who say, like, what's the insidious, like, sneaking the religious themes into the...
Yeah.
And you were just like, no, it was just an idea to, like, spin off into a different...
Yeah, it was... And also, I assumed, because this is, the origin of it goes back to 2004 or 2005. People think that... I mean, the first book was published in 2008, but we started discussing and planning them considering them way before that.
Yeah.
And at that time... Okay, Amazon existed, but it was not like it is now.
Right.
And the book distribution business was very different. And I assumed that these books would be distributed virtually exclusively into independent Christian bookstores. And the bookstores are like the Baptist bookstores and the various family Christian. I thought they would be like a totally geographically separate world and that they wouldn't even cross over. And of course, that was changing at that time, but I didn't know that.
Right.
Because I follow trade information, but that's not like something that I was on top of particularly. And also, it was sort of changing at the time this was going on.
Yeah.
And so when the books came out and sort of spread out there into the marketplace in general, I was very surprised.
It's because I was working in a bookstore at that time.
Yeah.
And that was one thing that we were noticing, like as it was happening, we were like, something Christian publishing is. Everyone's coming in to buy it. Like it used to be like one little section just in the religious section.
It was a very distinctive cultural change and marketing change. And of course, and so a lot of the books that we planned early on, they were in the pipeline even before I knew this.
Mm, sure.
Because you're working on books like a year or two ahead.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the early titles, I thought, well, we don't need to make these explicitly have religious titles because they're going to be part of a whole line of books in a Christian bookstore and everybody's going to know that they're all part of a religious right. line. And but then they started to get sort of split up and spread all over the place individually, and so people would find something like Don't Show Some Respect, yeah. which was a fairly early book, and they wouldn't have any idea. It wouldn't necessarily be clearly that it was religious, right. and they'd get it, and they'd think it was a Berenstain Bear book that had no religious content, and then they'd be pissed off that it did. So as I began to realize that, then I began to say, look, we need to make the titles clearly, at least have some clear clue, even if the people aren't paying attention to what... And we started putting a faith story on the logo
okay.
as part of it, because we figured, hey, people aren't even getting this. We thought that just... We thought that they'd be positioned in the marketplace, but we were wrong. So anyway, that, I think that solved a lot of the problem, because now mm-hmm. people say, oh, well, this is one of the religious ones, or this isn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that would be a problem.
Well, it's not a problem you can be happy with, because it's obviously...
Well, you know, I don't want people who... I want people who are not interested in the religious side of it to go for the books that are not religious. I don't want them to, like, boycott the character. I'm not trying to get people angry. I mean, I've got, there are some people that are going to be angry no matter what, because they're sure. basically have a chip on their shoulder about something. Yeah. Oh, the whole idea that revolts them, but... I'm not trying to trick people into buying religious books. Is my point.
I think the one that was the most confusing, I don't know how much feedback you've gotten on this, is Christmas Tree. Because it was...
All the republishing. Yeah.
It was republished as the same title and the same basic
yeah, well,
story.
I assume that has been out of print so long that the in effect... I mean, although folks like you would know the old edition, I was assuming that was forgotten in the marketplace.
Right.
That's both of our favorite book of all time.
That's my favorite
yeah,
book.
I mean, that had its lifespan and sure. did well for a few years, but then it went out of print, and I tried to get Random House to bring it back into print. Huh. They weren't interested. So Donovan said, are there any out-of-print books that might be adaptable? And I said, well, hear about this. And they said, sure. Now, that was actually kind of a crisis, that book. And maybe you would like to see the stacks, and I can explain why it was such a crisis.
Yeah.
Would you like to see the files?
Yes.
The crisis.
Thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed part two of our meeting with Mike. You know what? We haven't even gotten to the archives yet, as you could hear. Don't worry, folks. We'll be getting there. Now, obviously, a lot of the upcoming stuff is going to be visual because Mike was showing us things. So I'll make sure and put as many photographs as I can in the show notes. Just go to berenstainbearcast.wordpress.com to see some of the stuff that Mike showed us. So we've got a few more little bits and pieces with Mike coming up. Some stuff at the Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. It's exciting. And again, I'm going to be portioning these out as they come. So if you're looking to see hear more about Bear Country, you can find us online at berenstainbearcast.wordpress.com. You can find us on Twitter at bstainbearcast. You can write to me at berenstainbearcast@gmail.com. Please go to iTunes, rate and review the show. We've gotten quite a few reviews and I would love to hear more. Let me know what works. Let me know what doesn't. If you like the show, please just star us, subscribe to us. Anything that boosts our presence online always helps. Also, if you go to patreon.com/deepinbearcountry, you will find our Patreon page where you can give some money to the show. Again, it costs a little bit of change to produce this. I've got to buy books. I've got to maintain my equipment. I've got to pay for hosting. It nickels and dimes. Yeah. So if you can spare anything, I would really appreciate it. There's a few tiers of that you can be a donor at, and if you donate a certain amount, then there's a few certain little benefits and bells and whistles you can get for being a patron of my podcast. Again, no pressure. I'm going to keep doing the show regardless, but it would help to get a little financial assistance. That's it. That's all I'm going to say about Patreon. But for everyone else out there, thank you so much for listening. I'll be back with more books in the future, more big chapter books, and I will see you all next time deep in a bear country.